Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Our guest today is Gregory Pardlow, author of Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America, just published on April 10th by Knopf. Gregory, before his incarnation as an author and memoirist, wrote and still writes poetry. In 2015, Gregory won the Pulitzer Prize for his collection Digest. He has also held fellowships with the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the New York Foundation for the Arts. His first poetry collection was Totem. Now, Air Traffic is a memoir of a brilliant and charismatic father, Gregory's, and his rise
Senior.
And fall. Excuse me?
Senior, yeah.
Senior, sorry. In part because of that, if we want to call it a fall, Gregory joins the Marines, travels around the world, returns to the States, and gets a job at his family's jazz club. The memoir follows Gregory as he creates a life for himself that includes his family but isn't defined by it. He also recovers from alcoholism and attempts to save his brother Robbie from the same fate. Although Gregory describes many failures in his life that he regrets, he also shares the learning process that has evolved from those. A lot of the story centers around the Delaware Valley where you, my listeners, sit right now, so that will help ease you into the narrative and bring back familiar places and times. And by the way, Gregory will be speaking at the Free Library downtown tomorrow, April 24th at 7:30 p.m. So visit the site now for the library and get tickets if you haven't done so already. And with that, welcome, Gregory, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Sam. It's great to talk to you.
So I guess the first question, and one that you probably get every time you do a reading or signing, is why did you temporarily move from your beloved poetry into the realm of memoir?
Well, I really didn't think of it as moving from one genre to another. It was kind of like I was just following my curiosity, and at some point I looked up from my desk, and lo and behold, I was writing prose. If you look at the work in the poems in the first book, there are a number of really long poems, and I think of those poems as lyric essays. And I started to work on a PhD at some point in the around 2003-2004, and I got really more and more interested in literary criticism and scholarship and research, and so I wanted that to go into the work as well. And so, like I said, it's been a really organic process, and I didn't really think I was doing anything straying too far from where the normal conventions of the genre of poetry, but here I am, and I had this body of work, these essays, and we're marketing them, selling them as a memoir.
Well, you know, since in a sense it's the keystone of the book, why don't we start off by talking a little bit first about your father's tenure as an air traffic controller at Philadelphia International Airport, which is an airport I've been complaining and whining about for the past 50-some years. Talk a little bit about that and how its ups and downs, no pun intended, affected your family's life.
Well, I don't remember when my father started in air traffic, but I do remember as a very young kid visiting him in the tower. We even brought some of my friends from the neighborhood where we lived to go and visit with him. This is something that is absolutely unheard of today. You could even imagine that happening now. But so my relationship with my dad, my sense of him, and the work that he did was always centered in the tower. When the strike came around, I guess I had internalized a lot of the gripes and complaints that the controllers had. So when the strike came around, it seemed very sort of natural, and they didn't seem to be asking for anything outrageous. It seemed well within the bounds of the reasonable. And so my walking the picket line with my dad, I was absolutely confident that this was the right thing to do. So, and it came as a surprise not only to me, but obviously to my father and to all the other men in the union, when men and women, when President Reagan not only threatened to fire them, but eventually did, give pink slips to some 11,000 to 13,000 federal employees. Go ahead.
Yeah. What I was going to say was, how do you think, this is off topic, but how do you think that when Reagan replaced those air traffic controllers, why didn't there become this disaster in the skies? Why did overall, as you say in your book, it worked more slowly, but why did it work at all? I never understood that.
Well, precisely because they followed they granted the requests of the original, or the original requests of the strike, and that was they slowed down air traffic, they improved the equipment, allowed for a greater rotation of working hours. And so the other part of that is I'm not so sure that there were no accidents. I mean, there were certainly near misses, and there were certainly plenty of bungled orders. But we're not going to hear about that. And this is long before, obviously, any social media. And so the ability, Reagan's ability to control the narrative, which is another thing that I'm really interested in this book, his ability to control the narrative around the strike was, I think, the key to the success. But the actual air traffic slowed down greatly in the weeks and months following the strike.
You know, it's funny, maybe you do and I just missed it, but in the book, does your father or even you now hold some resentment to Reagan for the manner in which he acted? Or in retrospect, do you feel like...
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Because as a kid, you know, if I go back to my child's eye view, Reagan was Darth Vader, right? I mean, he was absolutely the villain of this story. But now, looking back on it and understanding how politics works and understanding how this, he was a brand new, maybe for 8 months in office, president, being challenged by the union so publicly, he kind of had little choice but to respond in this really swift and demonstrative way. It's not to excuse that, right? But I try to take out my emotional response reactions to the strike and think about it from a more pragmatic view. And in a way, in like family history, that is my own, the family history as I imagine it, Reagan is kind of the alter ego to my father.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, it's funny too, like we were talking about before the show, is that I grew up in Mount Airy at Upsall and Ardley Street.
Oh, wow.
And then, and later on I moved to Willow Grove. So it was like, I'm older than you, so you kind of followed me. My brother and I used to go to Willow Grove Park, the amusement park there, and go to the bowling alley there, which is all.
I learned how to ride a bike in that parking lot after it was closed.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, my brother and I etched our names into the sign there, and I think it still might be there. Well, no, everything's gone. But for a while, it was the largest bowling alley in the world. I remember that. You spent a lot of time in areas around Philadelphia where my listeners are, and it does seem to, you hearken back to it a lot. You hearken back to Philadelphia in those areas. In your book, you know, I know you go to Princeton and other places, but it seems like Philadelphia in a lot of ways was your home.
Well, I'm trying to forge a sense of home, really. There's this feeling of estrangement from a sense of grounding, personal grounding. And Philadelphia had been, had always been the family home. And so my telling stories about it were kind of my way of rehearsing my relationship to Philadelphia and my way of writing myself into the history of Philadelphia and my ancestry in Philadelphia. Our stories, as I say, don't begin in, or they do begin in Philadelphia. They don't go beyond Philadelphia. So I don't know anything about my ancestry beyond those first generations in Philadelphia.
Well, I guess, and this is kind of a poetic question, but when you think about it in your heart, what do you consider your home? I mean, do you have like a feeling in your soul as to what home is?
I think Brooklyn now is what I consider home because of my kids and because my wife and I have worked so hard to build this home. Willingboro, the town I grew up in South Jersey, was the place in which I formed my identity. But there was always, because of the architecture, perhaps, there was always a sense that there was something disposable about the town, that there was something that the town the people were transient, and that there wasn't the kind of permanence that I associated with, you know, the Philadelphia, where the architecture of the buildings had been there since colonial times, and you can imagine, you know, history actually being present around you.
What was it?
Well, I'd say, that was just to finish up. I think Brooklyn serves all of those desires for me today.
Yeah, now you're in the 917 area code instead of the 215 area code.
Yeah.
So a lot of the book deals with, it does. It deals with your struggles, your self-destructive behavior. As I asked early on, that had to be really hard to get to and to write about and tell your readers about what kind of person in a negative way.
Yeah, well, you know what? The biggest problem, so I have the benefit of having written sort of almost confessional poetry. Perhaps I would even call it confessional. Some would call it confessional poetry already.
Right.
So, that, as I said, that kind of exposure is not foreign to me or really daunting because I could hide behind the language. I think, having had that experience, I think about the writing process like this. I can always find a reader who's going to judge me or my work negatively. But that has never been the object of my writing. The purpose of my writing has always been to find the reader who says, I'm inspired by this work. I am I'm encouraged by this work to do the kind of self-reflection that this author is doing or this poet is doing. And that makes it beneficial to me, the reader. And so as long as I have that reader in mind, it's not that scary.
Yeah, and the thing that's really interesting is it goes back to your dad, because I don't know if I'm getting it wrong, but he was almost like kind of your negative reader.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of my writing process, I've found that, and I guess this is true, I think, for most, if not all, writers, is that you write with a negative critic in your ear all the time, right? And there's this, whatever that voice is saying, oh, you know, you're not smart enough, you're not interesting enough, why are you doing this, why are you doing that? And that voice, that critical voice, for me, very much was my dad. And so back to your previous question, what made the book difficult, or one of the biggest challenges of the book, was to neutralize that voice, was to neutralize my father in my imagination so that he was not the thing I was responding to, and instead I was responding to or reaching out toward a reader who needs to be in conversation with me and my work.
Well, you know, it's funny because I listened to one of your interviews, and, you know, you had those last conversations with your dad, and one of the things you said, I think it laughingly, was, no, he hadn't changed a bit. So what were those last conversations while you were writing the book and looking for, you know, the heart of it? What were those last conversations like?
Well, a lot of our conversations in the very end were through text messages because he was too weak and he would lose breath very easily. And I hadn't heard from him. I knew he knew that we had sold the book, and I hadn't heard from him for a few days. And so I reached out to him and I said, Hey Dad, did you hear we sold the book that you and I had been working on for these past so many months? And the only thing he wrote back was Denzel Washington. In other words, when this book, and this, again, you know, this is the idea of this is all in service of him and his ego.
Right.
When the book, which is in praise of him, gets turned into a movie, he wants Denzel Washington to portray him.
It's just like when he bought the car and bought the boat.
Yeah.
Denzel Washington is just another boat.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great way to put it, yeah.
That's hilarious. You know, you gotta, in a way, and it's because of you, you have to admire him. And I guess, you know, you must be torn between this, and you express it in the book, you must be torn between this admiration and, you know, this idea of this guy's constantly beating you over the head. It's like my dad.
Yeah. It's like, well, as I was saying about the way I think about Reagan, right? And so
yeah.
as I become a father myself, an adult, and I see how difficult it is just to be a grown up in the world and to, you know, have some semblance of consistency in the ways that we get things done, I gain a new respect for my dad, and I understand the demons that he's working with. I don't know if I understand them, but I certainly sympathize more with the demons that he's working with, and understanding that he has an entirely different context for his relationship to the world than I do. And again, you know, this is not to forgive anyone for anything. It is to forgive. It is to unburden myself of the impulse to resent my father. And that maybe that's a form of forgiveness. Maybe that is forgiveness.
My father was like really larger than life. And I guess your father was in some sense too. And, yeah. You know, he'd always call me a jackass. And it took like years of therapy for me to realize when he was calling me a jackass, he was saying, I love you.
there was something affectionate about it, right?
Yeah. And it, you know, but at the time it was like horrible. It was like, you know, part of me is going, I'm not a jackass. Why is he calling me this? And I must be a jackass because he's calling me this.
Right. At the same time, he wouldn't say this so otherwise. Yeah, my father used to say, whenever I asked where we're going, you know, kids, you're always asking, are we there yet? Where are we going? How far is it? My father's answer was always Cleveland. Shut up.
Well, it's like my dad, you know, he was a workaholic, so he was in the building business, and he'd work even on Saturdays. So we'd only got to see him really all day on Sunday, and he wouldn't say a word. And we'd go driving just like you did.
Oh, wow.
And we'd be sitting there for 3 or 4 hours. My mom didn't say a word. My two brothers didn't
silence.
Say a word. Yeah, total silence. and they're both smoking in the front seat.
and with the windows closed.
Right? Yeah. How did that happen? It's like the smoking and non-smoking sections that used to be on airplanes, you know? It's like, it's the same
area.
Right. Well, you know, I thought initially that this was going to be peripheral to the book, But like when you're talking about your brother, Robbie, and I remember his music, and I don't remember the show, but talk a little bit about, you know, how he figures into all of this, because like I said, at first I thought this is just going to be like kind of an aside, but it really wasn't. It was a big part of the book.
Well, I think my experience is similar to yours, and my experience in writing Robbie into, or my experience in thinking about how Robbie works in as a character in the book, as a presence in the book. I started out in the early essays, and the essays in the book were not by any means written in the order that they're presented. But in the writing process, my thinking about my brother was sort of as a source of guilt for my inability or my failed responsibility, not only to him, but he turns out to represent, am I my brother's keeper, this larger sense of community. And so the guilt that I have over not participating in the communities that I've chosen in really productive ways. Over the course of the book, I grow more sympathetic to Robbie as I did my father and as I do with my mother in the book, and start to understand, think about his motives and the things that he wants in the world and out of life in general. And it becomes apparent to me that he and I are leading not really mirror lives, but sort of inverse lives, perhaps, in many ways. And so he becomes not the voice on my shoulder, but the phantom in the mirror. And he becomes this way of me thinking through a lot of the mental health issues that have concerned me and have troubled me over in life, and certainly the alcoholism and my relationship to ambition. And I remember my father berating my brother for not performing. So we owned a jazz club. My family owned a jazz club in Pennsauken, New Jersey. And whenever Robbie came to the jazz club, my father would insist that Robbie go up on the bandstand and perform. You know, and here's this 17, maybe even 16-year-old kid coming in just with his family and being shoved onto stage. And you know, that's got to be difficult. And I think what he was looking for in life was just a way to own his own story, just a way to be himself. I'm talking about him in the past tense, but of course he's doing well. He's alive and well in Willingboro.
Well, for a short period of time, he kind of did achieve that, what he was looking for, in the music industry, right? And no.
How so? How are you thinking?
Just that one song that was popular and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think his whole relationship to fame was sucked out from under him by my parents.
Jeez.
So I don't think, you know, it's easy. We look at him, and I certainly would look at him in the early 2000s and see there's just the opulence and the bounty of success that he was enjoying. But I don't think he ever got to reflect on how he had what he had accomplished, because he was constantly being prodded from behind by my parents, being pushed along.
You know,
the other
component, and I won't keep dwelling on Robbie, but the other component is that you know, the show Intervention, which was like kind of ahead of its time in terms of reality shows, almost like the Kardashians or something like that. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? And it also reminded me like of a J.D. Salinger, that show, It's a Wise Child, when all the kids were on the radio show showing how smart they were. So how did that come about? And then why did you do it? And because, you know, yeah, why did it happen? Was it your dad? Did he didn't?
No, it was my mom. And this is another one of the questions that I'm wrestling with. Not so explicitly early on in the book, but certainly more explicitly in that last piece on the show. And that is, to what extent is my mother invested in Robbie's health, and that is in getting him sober, getting him help towards sobriety, and how much of that is my mother interested in getting Robbie back in the public eye and back on course with, you know, his budding celebrity? I think there's a little bit of both. There's certainly a little bit of both in her motives, and that challenged me when she invited me to be on the show, and when the producers of the show invited me to be on the show. I was conflicted about participating in it, and then I found myself wondering, well, how's it going to look if I'm not there? And then I'm concerned about my own appearance. You know, I don't want to look bad. And then now I'm just playing right into that narrative, the family narrative of, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. And it was really so confusing and muddled and complicated that I had to write about it. But living through the show, I was kind of on autopilot. It was because it was just so surreal. You know, I don't know what's going to happen next. I can't imagine. I can't even locate myself in this space, you know, with the cameras on one side, my constantly performing father on this other side, my suffering brother on, you know, the third quadrant. There were just so many things intersecting at once. It seemed to be another. If the strike is one pivotal moment in the book, then the bookend to that must be the intervention.
It's funny because I kind of want to say to you that it seems like you're still kind of conflicted, but I didn't want to say it like as an insult. But the thing about it is,
I realize
I am too, with still thinking, my dad's been gone for 24 years and still thinking every day, what would he do or what would he say, or knowing what he would say? And the same thing true of my mom, who's 95 and in better shape than I am. And I can say stuff about my mom because she'll never listen to my show. She has no desire to ever hear me talking on the show. You know, it's like, what do you do that for? You know, why would you bother doing that? So I guess even after writing the book, I'm thinking, yeah, there's still things going on in his head. I guess there are, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had to, I think one of the upsides of there are a number of upsides in writing the book, but one particular is that I had to learn how to be comfortable with not knowing, how to be comfortable with not putting a definitive, you know, happily ever after on each essay. My impulse as a storyteller, as a writer, is to craft the comprehensive story that we can all kind of, you know, feel good and walk away from and say, whew, glad that's over. We made it through that. But life goes on. I'm not, particularly in relation to my own life, I am at no point confident that I have a grasp of what's going on. And, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, I don't think so either.
It's okay to live life in an improvisational manner. I mean, we want to have some kind of long-term narrative that we're living into, but, you know, part of enjoying life and being present in the moment is not imposing expectations, at least not into the to the point of saying I already know what the ending is.
Yeah, there doesn't have to. Well, it's like, you know, in novels, my brother loves to have novels that end with an ending where, you know, it's there's a gift wrap box and the
absolutely
bow is,
yeah, we all do. We well, all no, we're no, culturally.
I like it when there's I don't know what's going to happen. I like it when I have to, as the reader, project outward, and the, it's like the author is giving me the task. You know, I'm done. Here's my kid. You interpret it anyway. Mm-hmm. I love
well, you
that.
Know what, Sam? I wonder if the I would bet that culturally we as Americans like the pop story, the popular story that gets wrapped up in the end. I think you're probably certainly a more sophisticated reader than the average reader. And so what you're looking for is to be challenged beyond the pop cultural ending. You're more surprised, you're more interested in the surprise endings, the inconclusive endings. But I think at the, you know, at root, we are, as Americans, mostly conditioned to think about our lives and experiences in terms of that storybook ending, fundamentally.
Well, let me ask you one last question. Obviously, you're still doing your poetry, but has writing this piqued your interest so much as to lead you into the idea of perhaps doing short stories or maybe even a novel?
Nah.
Well, that was simple.
Yeah, talk about sophisticated
yeah,
thought.
That was real poetry. Yeah. Nah.
It's real poetry.
Actually, it is actually the essence of poetry when you think about it. Well, all right, well, that's a great way to end. All I wanted to say is thanks for being here, but I wanted to tell everyone again that you'll be speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia, where Gregory grew up and I've grown up, and that'll be tomorrow evening, which is Tuesday, April 24th at 7:30. And if you just go, just type Free Library of Philadelphia, you'll go right to their site, and you'll be able to get tickets. And hopefully I'll see you there. I'll be there. And once again, Gregory, thanks so much for being here. I loved your book, and I love talking to you.
Thanks, Sam. It's been a great conversation. Really fun talking to you.
Likewise. We were talking with Gregory Pardo, author of Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. A really telling book which exposes to us an entire life, you know, in a way that most of us are not willing to talk about, or maybe we're willing to talk about, but not to everybody. And it's a familiar story, you know. It's a father who's multifaceted, some positive aspects, some negative aspects, likewise with his mom. And but not something he couldn't talk to them about. And I don't know, it was really different because it, I guess, showcased what happens to you when your family pushes you so much towards a particular place and you either have to rebel, compromise, or just fit in. And it gives you the aspects of his life that kind of plug into all three of those things. Anyway, it was a really good interview. And like I said, visit him tomorrow for a reading and signing at the Free Library, the 24th. So join us every week on The Avid Reader. There will be more insightful and engaging discussions with most of today's most compelling authors, because Rebecca does such a great job getting them for me. Upcoming guests include Christopher Moore, who you all know. He's going to discuss his latest novel, Noir. And Jody Fields will share her recent book, which is a really good thriller, medical mystery. It's called The Winter Station. So, as always, thanks so much for listening, and we hope to have you back here again next week on The Avid Reader.